Support for PopCast comes from Sound Opinions, a podcast from WBEZ Chicago. Each week, noted music critics Jim DeRogatis and Greg Kot review new releases, discuss classic albums, and conduct exclusive interviews with artists across musical genres. Sound Opinions is a space for music lovers, fans, and critics alike to share in the conversation. Sound Opinions. Listen critically. Download Sound Opinions wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your fall from grace, but oh, what grace it was, of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Is Whitney Houston, I Have Nothing. We are in the middle of kind of an intense period of Whitney Houston re-examination, scrutiny, and analysis. Most recently, there is a new documentary called Whitney, which just came out in theaters a couple weeks ago and hopefully will still be in theaters by the time you're listening to this podcast, although I don't know. And Whitney is the second documentary that we've had on Whitney Houston in 2 years. The previous one was called Whitney, Can I Be Me? Came out last year. It was unauthorized. This one is made with the participation of her family. Both of them are pretty unsparing in their assessments of Whitney Houston's later years. Today on PopCast, we're going to take as a given that you love Whitney Houston, that you think Whitney Houston is important and magical and transcendent and all those things. And if you don't think that, you definitely listening to the wrong podcast. Like, I don't know, there's probably, I'm not going to name other podcasts, but like, you can certainly go listen to one of those. I mean, it's just accurate.
Wow.
Sorry, shots. But to talk about Whitney's representation and how media has handled her following her death, I got a gangbusters roundtable. I'm starting to my right. I've got Rich Jezwiak. Rich is a senior writer at Jezebel. And as anyone who has followed Rich on the internet for many, many years as I have, Rich is about that life. It's about that Whitney life.
Yeah. I've been living it all my life.
It's a real thing.
My life has been that Whitney.
It's real. It's real thing. To Rich's left, it's Alan Light. What's up, Alan?
Hey, John.
Okay, so Alan is the co-host of a show on SiriusXM called Debatable, which is fine. That's great. I'm happy. But Alan is also the former. Alan is the former editor-in-chief of Vibe, the former editor-in-chief of Spin, and also wrote about the Whitney Houston documentary for Arts and Leisure a couple weeks ago. Alan, what's up?
Happy to be here.
Joe Coscarelli, what's good, man?
I'm here.
Joe's here. Joe's pop music reporter in the New York Times. And Joe is with us, as always.
Yep. As often as you'll have me.
That's accurate. And finally, first time on the podcast. Actually, Alan's first time on the podcast as well.
I guess that's true.
Yes, that's true. Sorry,
I don't know if I've done with you.
I did not mean to not mention that. To my left, Naima Cochran.
Hello.
Naima is a longtime industry veteran, worked in marketing for many, many years. I know Naima on Twitter. At Naima.
But I know you as somebody who used to review my artists.
Wow. And you're still here.
Still here.
Wow.
Give us a quick one. Do you remember one specifically?
Oh my gosh. I'm not going to name any names, but it was definitely like, what did John Caramonica say about the show? What did Karen Caramonica say? But yeah, I'm here.
I guess apologies? I mean, not really. Naima on Twitter once a week does a thing called Music Sermon, hashtag Music Sermon. If you are into 80s R&B, off the beaten track, one of the rules, no Whitney. No Janet.
No Whitney, no Janet, no Prince, no Michael, except in the context of broader mm-hmm. subjects, but sure. I don't focus on them. And we're a B2K focused ministry we do before 2000. For
oh,
the most
I thought
part.
It was B2K.
No,
literally
before
B2K.
2000.
Oh my God.
Absolutely not B2K.
Oh,
before
B2K. Marcos Houston is not yeah. your B2K.
Wait till I come with the ill music sermon on B2K.
I'd read that.
That would happen.
Followed by the music sermon on mindless behavior. I mean, I'm just
immature.
Okay,
yeah,
you're
mature with their day.
That's how you want to be a guest. Preacher,
I would love
come
to
and do a whole series.
Can I do a Latin freestyle? Music
Absolutely.
Sermon? Okay,
I would love it because people have been asking me for something like that, and I'm just like, I don't know if I'm the person to do it.
All right,
it.
So exclusive.
We'll talk offline.
Yes, we're gonna talk. So anyway, if you, this is one of the only good things left on Twitter,
Thank you.
I feel like every day now I look on Twitter and someone's like, I'm leaving Twitter.
Every day.
I also like how people feel the need to announce that they're leaving Twitter.
I know.
Like, just go.
The more you announce, the less you actually leave.
That's exactly. what I'm saying.
And they also
the
come back.
Some have been leaving for months.
And then they come back and it's like,
you've been
gone.
I've been gone, but I did announce. I mean, I wrote about leaving, and then I mean, but I come back a little bit, but I still don't often. I don't even know where I'd start at this point. I used to tweet all the time, and now I just don't even know where I'd
it's
start.
Become,
anyway, here's
it's
the
become
thing:
a messy space.
Everyone should quit Twitter. Yes. Literally every person except Naima.
Right.
The only thing that should be on Twitter. So anyway, you should tune into that because you'll learn a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the few good uses of Twitter as a historical space, which is a thing that ostensibly it was supposed to be, but now it's accessible. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we all want to talk about Whitney. Yes. We've all seen the new documentary. We've all seen the old documentary. Can we talk first impressions of the new documentary? And I want to start off by saying something that I mentioned just before we started running, which is the emotional intensity of the current documentary, I think, would not have existed had the other documentary not been made.
Agreed.
There is nothing hagiographical about the new documentary. I would say it takes Whitney's genius for granted, but it almost just ignores Whitney's genius. It almost pretends it doesn't even engage with it as a subject, except in maybe like two or three quick flashes. It just sort of assumes you know who Whitney Houston is and then talks about her downfall. And I was really struck by, given that it was a family sanction filmed, how raw it was. And I want to hear what you guys off the rip were thinking.
I've never had a worse time thinking about Whitney Houston than watching this movie.
Shouts to Reed Rich's piece on Jezebel, where he slap boxes with the director and
it
talks
was
about
very
how unhappy
I don't
he
know,
was.
Alan, I don't know what your experience was with Kevin, but I found it to be incredibly tense. I mean, I had a very limited time with him. I went in there and I had questions, and that's what I did. And he didn't really like that, in my assessment. Mm. It was almost like a dismissive wave of the hand.
And this is the director.
Yeah, Kevin McDonald, who's an Oscar-winning director, will tell you in those words that he is a respected director. He told me in those
words. He said, I'm a respected director?
He said, I can read you the quote.
I'd love to hear that quote.
The only way people are going to respect the film, take the film seriously, is if it's from a respected filmmaker's point of view.
Which is him.
Wow.
Yes, which is him. Yeah. Yeah. As opposed to the family. So
that's type whack.
Yeah.
That's not a cool
light flex.
But to be fair, he has an Oscar, so.
It's true, but it wasn't that much. Like, it wasn't like it was that much more well done than Can I Live, to be honest. It really just seemed like a bookend piece to it. Like, it went a little bit more in depth. But also, he was trying to do, in my opinion, he was trying to do a little too much. Like, when he was intercutting all the actual historical clips from things that were happening in the world.
That are not
with her song.
Right.
Yeah,
but when he was doing it with her ascent, with I Want to Dance with Somebody, I thought that was cool. Because it very much fits in a kind, like, Whitney is very much a product of the 80s, right? So that made sense. But when he kept doing it subsequently later on, I was like, okay, this isn't really.
That was OJ Made in America light.
Yeah. It really was.
Yeah.
And
but
I
this
agree.
Should have been OJ Made in America heavy.
I agree.
Whitney needs a series. She doesn't need a movie.
See, I disagree with you, Rich, I think, and a little bit with you. I think this is a far better film than Can I Be Me. I thought that was cheap. It looked
I mean,
low
it's
budget.
Nick Broomfield.
I know. It's
my guy's the straight to VHS king.
Look, I know. Kurt and Courtney.
But who's also amazing.
Right.
Chicken Ranch.
I mean,
I'm here
it's
for.
It's like saying Troma film.
Right.
Nick Broomfield and Troma.
Oh, the Troma documentary.
I'm fine with like a slapdash sort of made for TV type
Right. He's a lifetime type beat.
Right. Yes. And I think the new film was really well made. I agree it was a little heavy-handed with the riot footage and whatnot. Like, some of that stuff is just irrelevant.
As our critic Wesley Morris wrote, it is the sign of a director that did not trust his material.
But the thing is, there was a lot of good material. There was a lot of good material. I feel like
strange.
The family stuff was great. I thought the interviews were strong. Obviously, you know, the use of music was better. The first documentary from last year was not authorized, so they didn't have access to a lot of the catalog. This one, obviously.
Or real interview footage.
Right.
They didn't have as much interview footage.
And this one they did. And I really liked, it was sort of like the inverse of Amy in that you never see the talking heads and you're getting sort of archival footage. In this one, there was a lot of nice new footage with archival audio put over it. And mm-hmm. I thought that was like an effective trick. Like when Sissy is in the church,
right.
Whitney's mother, and you're hearing Whitney talk about her upbringing. And, you know, I thought the interweaving of that stuff was good.
Rich, to what you initially said, I don't know that my conversation with the director was... that I would say it was tense in the way that it seems like yours was. What stood out to me, and I don't know if this is jumping too far ahead or not, is the thing that I did kind of challenge him with, which I think to me is what you, John, mentioned at the top, what's sort of glaringly missing in this film is really any sense of Whitney's relationship to her work and to her music and to her singing. And it's sort of presented as this superpower that she can turn on and turn off.
Like, but that also has no subtext or no meta narrative, of course, like at all.
No, if that's the point, fine, then make that the point.
Exactly.
But it never addresses what any of this meant to her and to what Joe was just saying about the Amy movie. So, you know, I don't even remember if I brought it up or he brought it up, but the way that what I think was great about the Amy movie was the way that the work and the life informed each other
completely.
In the film. And his answer basically was, you know, it's kind of too hard with Whitney.
Right.
That her, you know, she didn't write her own material. Her interviews were too facile and she didn't really talk about this stuff. And so anytime he asked people to talk about Whitney's singing, it was just kind of banal and didn't feel like it was doing anything in the film. And I kind of felt like telling me, you know, that's too hard, didn't really feel like the answer I was looking for the
Oscar
thing that seemed to be missing.
So he said.
To Joe's point, I think there's a lot that is really strong. Obviously, the family interviews and hearing her brothers talk about introducing her to drugs and things that you could get in this film that you couldn't have gotten anyplace else. There's stuff in there that is really powerful. But that, you know, this thing at the center of this is why we cared about her and that's not really dealt with is what's most problematic, and he didn't really have a good answer for it.
But he does. But he tips his hand in your story. He tips his hand. There is a quote which literally I hated so much I screen grabbed it because I wanted to make sure that if the reception in the Wi-Fi was bad today, I didn't want to not have the quote handy. So, Alan, you note that he says that he was not much of a fan of Whitney Houston, and I'm not saying that one has to be a fan to do credible criticism or films or be respected in your filmmaking. However, he says, quote, it felt like an interesting challenge making a serious film about somebody who was not taken seriously. This seems to be an incredibly myopic perspective on Whitney Houston. I, for one, did not know any human being in the 80s or 90s that did not take Whitney Houston seriously. So this seems like someone who comes to the party with a bit of a misapprehension of the larger narrative.
Rockist perspective.
Maybe, or maybe just like an out-of-touch white British guy perspective.
Well, and
or
somebody
who
made a documentary about Bob Marley, who would be the consummate person to point to as activist, mythic figure, you know, global power, where there's no question of taking that work seriously, contrasted with the sort of, you know, pop, not critics' favorite, everything else that Whitney dealt with, as we know, through the career. I mean, that if that's what he was drawn to, Whitney Houston ain't Bob Marley.
Right,
it's
but this makes
thing.
Me think this is a curious choice for the person to handle this particular subject matter.
Right.
I'll say that as a little bit of a counterpoint, I did get a portrait of Whitney in the new film, in Whitney, as a person who is broken, depressed, and lonely. And basically, they do say that you, when you say her voice is a superpower, they say she just wanted to be in bed. She just wanted to be on the couch. You know, there's this footage of her watching TV. You get this idea where, you know, people say like she'd rather be in bed.
Well, no, she wanted to be a singer. She didn't want to be a superstar. She didn't want that. And I think she says this in... And now I can't remember because I also watched Can I Live Again last night. Yeah. I watched Can I Live Again last night, so I'm going to probably mix up what was in some of them. But I think it was, she was doing an interview with Katie Couric, and Katie Couric said, that's Can I Live.
Can I be me?
Katie Couric asks her, you know, what the hardest thing is about, I think, you know, being a star, and she says the hard thing isn't success. And she says the hard thing isn't success. The hard thing is fame.
Yes.
That's the hard thing. And I think that's the thing for Whitney. Like what people really didn't understand about Whitney. First of all, her ascent was insane. Like even before Bodyguard, like she was Clive's jewel, you know, and he was trotting around like a dog and pony show. And she came from a, you know, black music royalty family and all this other stuff. And she was incredibly young and she was incredibly protected. And it was very much like she was putting on a facade from the jump, but she wanted to sing. She loved her voice. She loved that. She didn't want all that other stuff. And that's, I think Whitney did show that, you know.
And just to that point, and I wonder, I know that we probably couldn't have in this exact moment a movie that was, or a documentary that was strictly about Whitney's gifts as a singer. Because obviously what happened in the last 10 to 15 years, despite, Rich, I know you're going to problematize this a little bit later, but what happened in the back half of her career made her public image, there was too much toxicity.
Right.
Do you think on some level that the brush has been cleared away now with these two films, and maybe someone, maybe not this person, but someone else down the line could do something that was a more... I don't want to say conventional, but a documentary that really talks about Whitney as a musician, as an artist? Or is that basically completely off the table, both because of the arc that her career went in and also because the public narrative has just calcified too much about her?
Well, the end to me is, if in fact she didn't have a very strong relationship with her material, isn't it telling that she was able to sort of give it up to the extent that she did? She seemed to become completely disenchanted with fame and celebrity and being her. And that's what's fascinating about her to me, that you could have all of these gifts and just get so sick of it all, just get so tired of it. And maybe if the actual music wasn't something that she cared about that much, well, wouldn't that be like sort of an explanation?
Well,
for
that's
it, you know,
because I genuinely walk away from these films without a sense of her relationship. I mean, you say she wanted to sing. I don't know that I walk away from these films with like she wanted to sing. She felt like, you know, there's that one. There's actually, and I forget if Sissy says it or somebody quotes Sissy saying it, where we know Whitney's complaining that she's kind of coaching her too hard, and she says, you know, if you don't really want to be a singer, tell me that now, and we won't waste either of our time.
Right.
And you know, there's that sense that there are things that she was groomed for.
And also you're the thing where Sissy does the bait and switch with her at the R&B club.
Yeah,
the
R&B
club. It's like, oh, I couldn't possibly, I'm too sick to perform. And then all of a sudden it's like,
you're talking about somebody who literally was a model with the greatest pure singing voice of a generation.
Yeah.
You see what it is that's being teed up there. Did she want that? I don't know if she wanted that. And I think the question that Rich raises is totally a valid, I mean, that's right. I interviewed Whitney once, and it was for an EPK for the last album.
Okay.
And, you know,
tell
she
the people
was,
what an EPK is.
It was the sort of the video press release, you know, to put out. So it was the label hired me to film this thing with her that they could use for promotion for putting the album out. You know, and she was pretty good for the day.
And this is 99?
This is 99.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, the last album or?
For I Look to that. You.
Okay.
For I Look to for You. So it's 2009. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, 2009. My bad.
Sorry. That's what I meant. And she, you know, she was sort of mannered in the weird Whitney way, but she was present. She wasn't. But, you know, what she was saying then, again, I don't know. She's like, I like to sing ballads. She's like, I can do the rest. What I really want to do, I really want to sing ballads. That's when I really feel like I can be a singer. This was in a dumb, promotional, meaningless kind of an interview, but I kind of want to hear that somewhere in this conversation of what did she want to sing? How did she
conceive
envision
of herself
as an artist? What did that work mean? at this point in history, they're so inseparable.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's like saying, could you make something that's just about Michael Jackson as a vocalist?
Sure, right.
Well, you could, but how do you triangulate that without everything else around that?
Just as a quick sidebar.
But it's so absent from this.
As a quick sidebar, do you have any Whitney stories from the OG Vibe days that you want to drop on us?
I dealt with Whitney twice, was doing that, mm-hmm. Filming that thing with her. And we did a Vibe cover when I was editing for when Exhale came out. Danielle wrote the piece.
Yep.
And
Hi, Danielle. We miss
you. Out of all of those divas, that was the easiest one.
Really?
And was that because of Robin or was that because of Whitney?
I think it was a lot. I do think it was a lot because of Robin. I think it was because of another sort of mutual, friend of mine and friend of the magazine who was close to them.
Gotcha.
I think there was a lot of keeping it together, but she was like, I went to the shoot. She was on time. She was in a good mood. She was really happy.
And this is what year?
This is what would Exhale have been?
95.
Yeah, it's mid-90s. So I'll say I had, our Whitney experience was better than doing a Mariah cover, a Janet cover, a Toni Braxton cover.
Let's listen to something off the Waiting to Exhale soundtrack. Let's listen to Exhale, Shoop, Shoop.
Sometimes it's right for every win. Someone must fail, but there comes a point when we exhale.
Actually heard of Whitney pulling diva-ish. Like, you never actually heard of Whitney, doing the same things that you hear from Mariah or whatever. But first of all, her circle was so small. Very few people got access to her. But to go back to your point, Alan, I think, and to your initial question of, could you do a documentary that's just about her vocal talent and her career? The impression that we've always gotten is that Whitney never had choices in how she was going to come out, except for when she finally went and said, with the third album, I'm going to do R&B music, and went to LA and Babyface and did I Want to Dance with Somebody. And that was a conscious decision. But other than that, we have never seen where Whitney's choices were her own. It was Sissy and John, and then it was Clive and the label. And then, she stepped in at one point and was like, I want to go in this direction. But other than that, it was like she was always moved into place.
Right.
And I think that you can't tell one story without telling the downfall story, because that is what is crucial to Whitney's downfall, is that she wasn't able to do what she wanted to do. And we don't know what it was she wanted, whatever that was.
She said in one Vibe article.
She didn't seem happy when she was singing gospel, though. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, exactly. That's I can't remember when it was, but I'm pretty sure it was after the Exhale period. I remember reading at some point in Vibe where she said, I want to make a gospel album. And that's what she wanted to do. And that's the only sort of talk that I've seen her do on where she wanted to go.
Yeah, she was
whatever.
Clinging more to her gospel roots later in her career. Yeah.
There's also the conversation in the new documentary where she was filming Sparkle. Someone says they walked in on her in her trailer and she's up 5 a.m. listening to gospel. Like, that's her grounding.
Right.
I will say, I thought Whitney as a film did the better job of presenting her as this sort of pawn that everybody was moving around, right? You really get the stage parent thing, the Sissy Houston as, never came out with a big solo career. She's obviously pushing her into it at the beginning. And then, as you say, Clive sort of takes the reins. And then you get even the film agent who sort of is like, I basically put her in the bodyguard and made her this global superstar. You sort of get the jostling of her just sort of like floating in the wind and going a lot of directions.
Also, but the film agent who helped make the documentary.
Right, yes.
And got the director. Yes. We all have self-serving needs.
I did appreciate the inclusion of the line, or at least the sort of puncturing the urban legend that Clive was responsible,
like that,
was
he
that he made the discovery and made her happen. And,
right.
And
at least
say, no,
going back
Sissy.
to say there was a bidding war. Like, he didn't go find her and make her. The eyes were on her. He had the bigger checkbook and ended up
the better shirts.
Not to take the credit away from obviously good decisions to turn her into what he turned her into, mm-hmm. but it was I was happy to not just see it fall into the this is all about Clive's guidance.
Here's Whitney at her most ebullient in the 80s. This is I Want to Dance with Somebody Who Loves Me.
Support for PopCast comes from Sound Opinions, a podcast from WBEZ Chicago. Each week, noted music critics Jim DeRogatis and Greg Kot review new releases, discuss classic albums, and conduct exclusive interviews with artists across musical genres. Sound Opinions is a space for music lovers, fans, and critics alike to share in the conversation. Sound Opinions. Listen critically. Download Sound Opinions wherever you get your podcasts.
So I have a question, because one of the things that I discussed with John before we taped was that there's a lot in this documentary that was not secret to Black fans. We just don't talk about it, right? I think the only thing that might have been... First of all, I will say with both of these documentaries, I'd never heard that much about John Houston. And I don't ever remember hearing him talked about at all, really. And I was like in middle school when Whitney came out, I think. So I was old enough to like be paying attention, but I don't remember ever hearing that much about John Houston. So those things were a revelation to me. I didn't
Whitney's
remember.
Father, just
Whitney's father, I'm sorry.
And yes. that's in Whitney.
That's in both.
But more, I feel like it's heavy in Whitney.
Shady dealings. But they talk about the fact that he sued her in Can I Be Me?
And you get the deathbed interview in both.
I don't remember that at all. And I was actually at Arista for a short period of time when Whitney was there and doing some dealings with Nippy Inc., but I don't really remember hearing a lot about John. The other thing that I think were whispers, but that I had never heard said straight out, was the allegations of Dee Dee Warwick's abuse.
Uh-huh.
But even that was whispers. But I say all that to say, I think it was always understood that Sissy molded Whitney. I always assumed Dion kind of positioned Whitney, but Clive said in an interview that he had never even talked to Dion about Whitney. But the understanding was that Clive took her and polished her up and positioned her as a star, but not that he created this image. So was that a thought that Clive did this all himself? Like, because we all knew it was Sissy.
I think how Clive would like you to think of it.
It's certainly coming after the Clive book and documentary, the way that he would position it, for sure.
The press releases.
But he did mold the album. So we do understand that he had like that, the hand
that
there.
And,
But in terms of like the, but
it's
polishing.
But I'm glad we're talking about Clive, because I feel like one of the tensions that the current documentary alludes to, but maybe doesn't dwell on, you know, it talks about her getting booed at the Soul Train Awards. It talks about Al Sharpton calling her Whitey Houston, this idea that Whitney was not Black enough and that Black fans were turning on her if they had ever embraced her in the first place. They were turning on her. And I thought about that a lot in the context of what this documentary is and who is responsible for this documentary. So we now have two documentaries made by white British men, outsiders, not at least certainly in the case of the current film, not a Whitney Houston fan to start with.
I spoke to Broomfield when that film came out, and he said, I think virtually the same thing, which was this kind of, I wasn't a fan, but I'm fascinated by this phenomenon.
And that was Asif, who directed the Amy documentary. He said the same thing.
Right.
Yeah, I was on like a MSNBC with that guy, and I was like pretty blown away by how little he knew. That was very weird. But I say this because when I was watching the film, the current film, some of the moments that really stuck out to me were hearing this disembodied British voice interrogating this Black family and pulling their secrets out. And I was thinking a lot about what we keep private, who we tell things to. You mentioned Naima earlier. A lot of the stuff in this film is not news. known in the Black community. This is known in the worlds of people who are obsessed with R&B. These are things that people are aware
of. But I also don't know if Sissy would have given it to a Black director.
Well, okay, so this is... So, again, or a respected director.
Yeah. Right.
Keep, coming back. We're going to watch that guy for the respected thing all for this entire podcast. But I was very struck, and I'd like to hear more about that, because I also was left slightly uncomfortable by this idea of like an outside interrogator having to come in to extract secrets.
It's a little bit complex, you know. Like, when I was watching Whitney, I really, there were a few times where I was like... mouth open at how Frank, Gary, and Michael especially were being
brothers
on record. Her brothers were being on record,
and they were interviewed multiple times. Alan, you alluded to this in your piece. They were at Gary at least three times,
right?
But yeah, Michael especially, and then John III, who's her half brother. I was really kind of mouth open at how frank they were being, because there is, in a really hyper religious family, especially one that crafted a narrative like Whitney's, the reason she was so successful is because there was this rule of, there's just some things we're not going to talk about. And I know she's gone, and I understand that maybe that lifts some burden of secrecy, but I still did not expect her family to be that open. Now, Sissy was more selective. Sissy didn't really talk about anything, and her Aunt Bay, who I think is a family friend, was also very much like, no, nothing happened to Whitney. Right.
And we should make the point, we didn't hear a word from Sissy for weeks after this opened until, and I had closed my piece for Arts and Leisure.
Oh, really? Yeah.
We got this in online, but
I
not
see.
In print.
I see, it's in the online piece.
Sissy's statement essentially walking away from this film.
Because of the molestation.
Because neither Whitney nor Dee Dee are here to be able to answer.
And also, she's not quoted in the film reacting to that.
Speaking to that.
Because in your piece, you talk about how that interview, which is with Mary Jones, who's basically Whitney's day-to-day person.
Aunt.
Her assistant.
Personal assistant.
Right.
Yeah.
That interview only happened 2 weeks before Final Cut, basically.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. Before they had to submit.
Can we just back up a second? So, you know, we've already spoiled it. If you haven't seen the movie, it was spoiled. Right,
it was spoiled.
It's in the news, right?
Yeah.
So basically, Whitney, the film that's out now, sort of leads up to this big reveal, which is that Whitney had told, according to the film, people around her that she had been molested by her aunt, Dee Dee
Warwick. And that her brothers had as well. And Gary admits it as well.
Cousin Dee Dee.
Dionne Warwick's sister.
Yes, Dionne's sister.
Yeah.
Now, I'm curious what you guys think about how the movie handled this reveal. To me, it was a little overplayed.
Yeah,
I think,
tasteless,
you know, it's presented as the key to her entire brokenness, right? And it leads, and it's in the last, 15 minutes of the film
when it finally comes.
So I wonder what you thought about that how it was presented.
The biggest problem I have with both documentaries is having people speak on Whitney's behalf, using these elements from her life and saying, oh, well, because she was molested, she didn't know what she wanted. She was sexually fluid. Or like the Broomfield documentary opens, Whitney died of a broken heart. All of this chatter, it's Mary Jones is not a licensed therapist. She is somebody who has certainly heard from Whitney. She's more of an authority on Whitney's life than I am. She's worth listening to, but she still doesn't know the exact nature of the path of Whitney Houston's sexuality, and she is presented as an absolute authority, and I have a big problem
with
that.
But she's an old Black woman.
Sure.
And I hate to say it like that, but you really have to understand some cultural context in terms of conversations about Black sexuality. They're looking for a reason for Whitney's sexuality. Mm-hmm. That's kind of, I think, part of what you have to understand, and it's much easier to say, oh, this must be what it was about, than to just say, it's just who she was. It's the way that Robin Crawford, who was Whitney's longtime friend, companion, her creative director, you know, ran all her stuff business-wise, but was also longtime rumored to be her lover. Her family hated Robin. When Whitney moved out of her parents' house, she moved in with Robin. She had been friends with Robin since she was 16 or 17 years old, and her brother, her mother, father, everybody around her hated Robin because they knew Robin was a lesbian. And because of the rumors of Whitney, or maybe they knew about Whitney and Robin. And
still hate her, by the way.
Still hate her.
Or you can see Gary's
still hates her. Like, they call it wicked, evil.
I knew what she was.
Says she was a lesbian. I mean, it's just like...
said her father was maybe going to hire somebody to like
to take her legs out.
And then there's a tabloid story that they show the clip of about.
And they basically confirm it.
Yeah, we just didn't do it because we didn't know
how it was going to go out.
Again, I was watching Gary and Michael's interviews like, what? Did they know they're on camera?
Your oh no, they didn't could never. Your gossip could never. Your shade room could never.
So anyway, I want to just go back to like with Mary and everybody talking. They themselves are looking for reasons for Whitney's sexuality and or what they maybe don't even want to admit to themselves about Whitney's sexuality. And because she was positioned as like America's sweetheart, it is true. Like everybody wants to know, like, who's she dating? What's she doing? But even Bobby wasn't good enough for them, for her, even though Bobby is exactly like her brothers. It's not okay. But I just say maybe give them a little bit of grace because they just don't know better.
Oh, I'm not mad at Mary Jones. I'm mad at the way that her opinion is positioned in the movie
as the absolute authority. Is what it was.
I feel like Mary Jones, I feel like so much of what she knew about Whitney, she didn't even say. She is absolutely an authority on Whitney. But just to position it this way, the way that the movie does it, the way that the two movies do it.
Yeah, it's Rosebud, essentially.
Exactly. Like, smoking gun. Yeah.
But this is a question for everybody, mm-hmm. I guess, because a lot, some of that does, not to get too lost in the detail, but some of it does come down a little bit to whether you accept this timeline that Kevin MacDonald laid out for the making of the film, which was we got this revelation, you know, 2 weeks, like finally Gary had sort of been talking around it, whatever, and then he sort of said this is what happened. Then we could go to Mary Jones to say, okay, is that what she was saying to you? And then we put the pieces together of the family confirming, yes, she talked about this molestation, this abuse. And then this all sort of rolls out from
there. You think he's lying?
Was that timeline their excuse for not going back to Sissy?
Did he
go back to everyone?
He had final cut and he had, you know, and then he had to pull that together 2 weeks and pop it out at Cannes. And I don't know what they saw when, and that's why Sissy's after the fact disowning this film, I don't know that she knew what was coming.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know what the obligation is. I don't know what the responsibility is there. But, you know, there is the question of, as you said, this comes through more than 3/4 of the way through the film is this moment that then, now we see what all of this
is. But I knew they were setting it up.
But was there another way to utilize that would have been a different... That would have told a different story.
I knew it was going to come as soon as I saw them put Dee Dee in the opening when they were talking about her family. Yeah. There's no other reason to put, like, nobody knows who Dee Dee Warwick is in the whole world. So I'm like, I didn't even know that footage existed of Dee Dee Warwick. So the only reason to put her in there, and then midway through when they asked, did anything happen to Whitney when she was a child, that would lead to, I was like, okay, they're building up. Yeah. I don't think it needed to be like this bomb at the end.
Right.
I don't think that at all, because clearly they've presented enough other evidence for ways in which Whitney was troubled and disturbed and bothered. And, you know, that can lead to all this other stuff other than just, oh, she was molested.
Guys, tell me if my interpretation of this is wrong, but I took Mary's explanation of the molestation and how it related to Whitney's sexuality to be about her being closeted, not as an excuse for why she was gay, but her saying that she felt she had to be with someone like Bobby because...
To prove that she was straight.
Yes, because the molestation had so sort of scrambled her brain.
I don't know. I felt...
Was that Mary who said that, or was that Pat?
Didn't she say she didn't know what she was or something like that?
I feel like somebody else felt that. Yeah. There was another person, not Pat Houston, but there was another woman that they were interviewing who was close to Whitney, whose name I can't remember. I don't think it was Pat.
Hairdresser, maybe
there was her, but maybe it was two different. Yeah, maybe it was two different. I think it was either the hairdresser or it was not Pat, but someone else who was saying she felt like she just needed to be married, have a family.
Yes,
like
that's what I'm referring to.
Yeah, she just wanted to prove to herself that she was somebody she felt like she was supposed to be.
I just didn't think that the film presented it in an entirely homophobic light.
And I don't necessarily, I mean, like, look, I don't think that somebody who's going to sit there and listen to these stories and understand somebody's life enough to like hypothesize about them is necessarily homophobic. I did not mean to position Mary Jones as anything. I mean, she came on and she told her truth. That's what she was asked to do. It was much more about the filmmaking.
The deployment of it.
Yes, exactly. The like, okay, Mary Jones said that, so this is the absolute truth. Whitney Houston didn't know who she was because she was molested, and that's way too pat.
Let's listen to a little peak pop Whitney. Let's listen to You Give Good Love.
I found out what I took some time for me to see.
To pick up that line of thought, Alan, I think you kind of get to this a little bit in your piece. And I think, Rich, maybe your question about how that piece of information is used in the film is all tied together with this. But I start to wonder whose questions are being answered here. Are they the director's questions? Are they fans' questions? Are they the family's questions? And there is a thing, I think it's Alan in your piece, where he sort of says, like, that piece of information was the thing that he'd been on a quest, and then that was the thing, and he had finally cracked it. And he said, you know, halfway through the filming, I think, he said he started to have... It could be a self-serving narrative. Who knows?
Who knows? But he, you know, it did seem like this became something that he was pursuing in, you know, he felt that watching how uncomfortable Whitney was with her physicality, hearing in a, you know, this one interview with the BBC where she started talking about how she hates people who abuse children, that's kind of out of nowhere. And like, what was that about? And he said, speaking to addiction specialists about how was it that these three siblings all had these extensive, you know, that there's something else that's going on in situations like that, that he felt like things were, you know, pointing toward there was some trauma, you know, something that could explain that, which is where he started to get that from Gary, which is where then he sort of closes that with Mary Jones.
And Rich, I think that's when I heard, when you said what you said before, it just got me thinking that is the ending that the director was striving
for. Right.
And I'm not saying it's inaccurate or even incorrect to contextualize.
No,
that way,
sure.
But it is where he was going.
And to your point, he said exactly this to me. It wasn't in the piece, but he said, to me, when I feel like I understood her is when I discovered this information. I don't understand everything about her, but it made a lot of things make sense to me. I count myself in the making of this as a journalist. And as a journalist, my job was to try to understand her.
Well, I think the problem that I have with these two films and the Amy documentary as well, which I'll keep looping in because it is, you know, so similar in structure and in content, you know, except her career was much shorter, obviously. But they all seem to be operating from this place of the question, who killed Whitney Houston?
Right.
Who killed Amy Winehouse? And obviously that's the most interesting question for an outsider, but that's not what I care about in examining these two careers. Who killed them? Because it's a fake question and with a fake answer.
But I do think to John's question about, like, is it the director's question? Is it the fans' question? There's a whole group of fans out there who the whole thing that they want to know is, like, who do we blame for Whitney's death? Who do we blame for Whitney's drug use? Who do we blame for Whitney's demise? And for many years, that answer has been Bobby Brown. And
Speak on it. I know you've been waiting.
I've been waiting because I feel like Bobby, listen.
It's your prerogative. Let's go.
Bobby was a trash husband. He was. He was a trash husband.
Allegedly.
He was a trash person. He acted out on purpose. That part
That stuff was great in the documentary.
If you were a member of that time, like, it was every other day, and this was before blogs. Like, every other day, Bobby's in the news for getting arrested, right? So he was jealous. He was really acting out on purpose. But that's really Bobby's story, because what you have to remember is that Bobby was at his pinnacle when he met Whitney, and then his career was on the decline as her star was ascending, and he just couldn't handle it. That's more about Bobby than Whitney. But I hope that people walk away from this really realizing, like, Whitney was who she was already. Bobby allowed her to relax a little bit and show that a little bit more. And Bobby being such a public spectacle maybe made her more comfortable with being a public spectacle. But, like, there was nothing in Whitney that wasn't there before she got with Bobby. And maybe it wouldn't have been as publicly on display had she married somebody else, but she still wouldn't have been happy. because it wasn't about Bobby.
So you
it
think he's taken else. Too much of the blame in the public
Absolutely.
Consciousness?
Absolutely. And it's been easy to assign blame to him because he was doing so much foolishness, right? It's been very easy because he was the quote unquote bad boy of R&B to say it's his fault. But Bobby doesn't even do hard drugs. You
also
know, it's
the
just,
real king of R&B.
Also Mike, the real king of R&B. The king of R&B.
Yeah, it was when interesting Michael, to hear Michael, right. Whitney's brother, refer to Bobby as a lightweight.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, and as you know, in the film, the brothers both talking about introducing her to drugs and the drugs that she was doing before,
way before
Bobby enters the picture. Now, he does himself, you know, no favor at all by refusing to even acknowledge that Whitney used drugs.
True.
By saying, you
I'm
know,
not talking about
I'm not talking about that. That has nothing to do with Whitney
he
Houston.
Refused. That's not good.
Which is
that wasn't
not
good.
A good, you know, does not
he looked, he looked great though. He
but
looks
I think
healthy.
We also have to remember in this that Bobby didn't just lose his ex-wife. He lost his daughter.
Oh, yes.
You know what I mean? But and they're
no,
so
horrible.
Deeply intertwined that for him, you probably can't separate them at all. And I'm sure there's some guilt there. I'm sure there's some heaviness there. I think him declining to talk about it was really more out of respect for Whitney. I think he's been trying to honor her in a certain way since she died that he maybe feels like he didn't when she was alive.
I think that cut with a little self-preservation because you can't talk about
too.
Whitney's drug use
without
talking
about
his own
craziness.
It,
right.
Naima, before we move on, I know you want to rescue Bobby's musical career.
y'all need to put some respect on Robert Beresford Brown's name.
That's
Bruno
right.
Mars, cut
listen,
the check.
Yes. Listen, Bobby really does not, and I'm going to be very brief, but Bobby really does not get his respect. And he was minimized by his relationship with Whitney, but Bobby was a star. Like, Bobby was a star. I think Don't Be Cruel so, like, almost went diamond. If it didn't go diamond.
Yeah, it's close to 10
million,
I think.
Yeah, it was, like,
ridiculous.
That album was on the charts for 2 years.
And it's
like,
wonderful.
He was touring.
It's a fabulous
And you could
album.
Still
Tremendous
put
record.
It on. I mean, and
what's a good Bobby deep cut we can play real
yeah,
fast?
Yeah, let's play deep it right cut? Now.
Oh, a deep cut. If you want to go
an
all the way back.
Cut.
If you want to go back to early Bobby, you can play Girlfriend.
Point about the relationship being somewhat of an image doctor or whatever, you know, she kept it in that space in her head the entire time. She told Oprah that she stayed with Bobby Brown longer than she should have to prove people wrong.
Right.
She had this huge chip on her shoulder about the public and what people thought of her and what people were trying to tell her to do. And she was just like, no, this is my life. And you're not going to inform me.
They
know?
Also definitely did have a very toxic brand of love. Like, I have
Absolutely.
No doubt that they had a love for each other that wasn't healthy. Like, a Whitney and Bobby relationship is still a joke that people make about a certain kind of
right.
love that you have. Like, it's completely dysfunctional, but y'all will, like, kill other people for each other type
right.
thing, right? And you almost can't breathe without each other. Like, they definitely had.
Yes, you could see it.
It was a real, like, being Bobby Brown.
Amazing.
There's a part of me that selfishly really wants them to put that back on the air, but I know it's awful.
Yeah,
it's
like, reality television history.
I just want a monitor in my home that just plays it on repeat.
It was the most fascinating TV. I wish Twitter had been around for it.
It was exactly 2 minutes on Being Bobby Brown. I know you're a scholar.
The most fascinating thing about Being Bobby Brown is, to me, what I alluded to previously, that it's a real study in just letting go of fame.
Yep.
I don't care. What's amazing about that show in retrospect to watch is that
Whitney was the star.
She was the star, and there weren't plots.
No, it was actual reality.
It was just Whitney and Bobby go to a restaurant. Mm-hmm. Whitney and Bobby go to another restaurant. Now they're shopping. Now they're sitting around the hotel room.
Now they're camping.
But they were so kinetic individually and as a unit,
entertainers,
you didn't need anything
down to the bone.
You genuinely didn't need anything.
And that was so impressive to me. And this is what the problem that I have with casting the last 15 years of her life as nothing but tragedy. It's like there was clarity through the haze.
Okay, this is where Rich gets to rescue you. You got to rescue Naima, rescue Bobby's solo
Bobby
career.
Rich is rescuing
the last 15 years.
Look, obviously there was a lot of mess, especially in the 2000s for Whitney. I think that, and maybe it was just me wanting to believe this, but I think there was a little bit of moment of triumph when I Looked You came out. I thought when she did Oprah and she was really, really frank, kind of self-lacerating in a way, I thought that was really impressive. I thought that performance that she did of I Didn't Know My Own Strength on Oprah was really moving. I think that like we allow some kind of vocalists to let their voices age and degrade with time. Joni Mitchell, for example, I don't think anybody would argue that the most recent Both Sides Now is, I don't think anybody would argue against that being the definitive version versus, and she has like maybe three fewer octaves in her voice when she recorded that versus when she did in the 60s. Whitney, to me, a real element of soul is being able to transmit your life through your voice, and you could hear Whitney's life tattooed on her voice by the end, which is what makes that recording and those performances so fascinating. Hey, hey.
My mama said I was not built to break. Dion said I was not built to break. Clyde said, come on back and sing, and I built to break. Your love said, your love said, I was not built to break. Oprah said, girl, do you know your love? Now I know my own strength.
There are very few things at this point in the Whitney catalog and public that could jar me. But one of the really jarring moments in the current documentary is the filmed footage from, I guess, the audience from the tour.
I closed my eyes,
it
literally.
It was rough.
I looked away. It's really rough.
And that's not to say that what you're saying about that album is untrue.
Yeah.
Right. But my sense is she could not deliver that reliably and consistently.
Yeah, that's not rough like late days Billie Holiday.
Right.
You feel all the pain, and it's a different voice, but it's powerful. That was just
what is gone.
And also, she shouldn't have been singing every night.
But it's also worth noting that that's not the kind of singer that Whitney was in her prime. It's so like it's not like you say, well, Mary J. Blige in her fifth decade will be singing these kinds of records. There was always something pristine, crisp edges, square corners about Whitney in her golden moments. So the idea that she would somehow in her middle or late age become full of grit and texture, you know, it maybe was not the direction that she was destined to go.
So to your point, Rich, yes, soul music has the imprint of the artist's life on it. Pop music does not. And Whitney's early stuff is, to John's point, it's shiny pop pop. And you could hear the soul breaking through.
Totally.
Like, especially in The Greatest Love of All. Like, you could hear the gospel on that. You could hear, we call it, you could hear the oil on it. You could hear the church on it, right? And so you could hear it break through in these selections, but the music wasn't really meant to convey soul. And I think that's part of the reason that people haven't been gracious with her, because her voice started declining immediately after The Bodyguard. So I Will Always Love You, you never knew what you were going to get when Whitney got on stage live, because she almost immediately after that could not hit those notes anymore, you know? And it was just painful because you knew it wasn't just age. You knew it was about neglecting her instrument.
Yeah.
You knew it was about just her not taking care of herself.
But you know that she would, that her answer to that would be like, it's my instrument.
True.
You know, like she, the thing about Whitney, the thing, I completely understand that. And as a fan, like when I see Mariah Carey today, you know, I mean,
she can't hold on those.
I mean,
pray for Mariah.
But I find that to be a really active listening experience. And I find it kind of interesting in a way too, that while I'm rooting for her to do well, her not doing well kind of adds to her character in a certain way to
True.
Me, you know?
Okay.
So, but
makes her interesting.
Exactly. But I guess the biggest sort of the thing, when I think about this stuff, I think, what did Whitney Houston owe us? Nothing. She could have gone away at any point in her life and she would have given us already so much by virtue of the fact that we knew her name. I guess the biggest, the saddest thing about that is that so much of her art was in the performance,
right,
much more than on the records. Kind of the inverse of Mariah, where
right.
Mariah is basically a recording artist who has to perform. Whitney came alive, and it's because she could. It was because she could be so alive in these songs, and she would sing them differently every night.
This is, I mean, that's the gospel in her as well.
Yes.
Whitney was a gospel singer.
Yeah.
She was not just gospel trained.
She was a gospel singer
who understood songs in that context.
Mm-hmm.
And when she did live performance, she treated it, even if the music was quote-unquote clean,
yeah,
it was church presentation.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know who gets left out of the narrative? And I'm kind of being facetious, but I'm really not. Ray J.
Oh, yeah, completely.
Oh, wow.
Seriously, because she was
the real
partying.
King of R&B.
But she was running the streets with Ray at the end.
Oh,
like,
wow.
He had her out in the clubs. He had her out partying even that weekend.
Yeah.
And nobody talks about
that. Oh, that's such
a
good point.
That's true.
Nobody talks about that at all.
Ray J's got slaps. Like, just as a...
He does.
He's got some slaps.
He does.
Just,
he does.
You know, let's put that out there. You know, Vince Staples has some really interesting
things
to say about Ray J,
details
too.
Details or not, it goes back to your point of, you know, the way, the reductive way that the story gets told, particularly the reductive way that the story gets told in relation to Bobby.
Yeah.
And not before, during, and after Bobby.
Right.
Not that this is a continuum within her life that, you know, maybe he amplifies.
Exactly.
But does not create, and it didn't turn off once
he
was
gone. It didn't turn
out.
Off once he was gone,
so
yeah.
So I think that's the, you know, that's the bigger point there, is that just kind of complicates the story too much, so it gets
right.
left
Bobby's
to the side.
Clean, he's remarried, he's got new kids, Whitney's at the club with Ray J. Like,
right.
You know, and it's just right. funny to me, like, he just kind of quote-unquote got off. Nobody was like, well, why was she still out partying? She's supposed to be sober.
Yeah.
Know?
I think to do, like, sort of the definitive Whitney narrative, he needed more time.
True.
You know, I just don't think you can tell her life in two satisfying hours. And that's what I admire the most about the Broomfield, which I know overextends its reach, et cetera. But it does. There is that narrative of 1999 and Robin Crawford's departure from her life. And all of that footage was there, made for something really fascinating to me. And
mm-hmm.
and actually rewatching that movie last night, which I did, Can I Be Me? Just like you, Naima. I was just so much more taken with Robin Crawford's story. I can't imagine what her life was like, to think about what she went through, everything she has put up with, and that she, you know, she wrote that one thing for Esquire when Whitney died, and that's it.
Yeah.
She is full of grace, that woman.
Yeah,
and
like
she said she's writing, working on a book, allegedly.
That's what the press notes say.
But
yeah.
Literally has, like, been quiet, even as Whitney's family has continued to vilify her, you know, had to mourn in quiet, couldn't even really, like, has never been able to acknowledge whatever her truth might have been, even if it was just, you know, Whitney was just very precious to me in a way that people can't understand,
right.
Like, was this was never able to say that.
And because of all that, you just can't help you walk away from this documentary, from the Whitney documentary, that, you know, Robin is the one person who seems to have Whitney's interest in mind.
Exactly. Yes.
Like, even as an absence.
Mm-hmm. And was resented for that.
And was resented for that, that everybody else, and maybe there's some other, you know, because we don't know, maybe we don't hear from Robin, there's another thing, but everybody else kind of drops away, the father, the brothers, everybody else is, you know, has turned on her, and Robin is the one thing that stays standing until she's not allowed to.
Right. Robin stays firm until Whitney also turns on herself.
Correct.
Yes.
And Robin is no longer allowed to be around.
There is a great moment in Whitney, the new documentary, about her national anthem performance mm-hmm. at the Super Bowl. And you hear her music director basically saying that he transfers it from, he takes it from 3/4 time to 4/4 time.
So Ricky it can Minor.
Be, so it can Shout be black music. And basically, you know, he said he played her the arrangement once and then she cut the take. It was interesting that they sort of allied the fact that she didn't sing it live. Mm. And he says, you know, oh, the version you're hearing, that was we just did that one take.
Well, though,
and then you see her singing it.
Though, of course, it is live because she did it in one take. She just did it in right. the studio.
Right.
But that's the one time when the movie slows down to talk about
the music
and to talk about the singing and how good she was. But again, even then, to go back to the point I was making way at the beginning here, the point of that ultimately is he sent it to her. She didn't listen to it all week. She listened to the arrangement once. She went into the studio. She cut it once. That's the one. And the whole world will never forget that. Now, that's an amazing story. But again, what you walk away from that is, she's this superhero who right. doesn't have to work at it, who can just turn it on, nail it, and move on.
And, move on. Yeah.
And again, that's interesting, but I would like to, again, know more about what her relationship was
with the
to that. And that's where when we talk about, I mean, with any of these, it's fascinating and fruitless to do the sort of, had she survived, what music would she go on to make with an instrument that isn't the pristine instrument of her youth. And I do think I Look to You as kind of widely overlooked and better than it's given credit for. But then it also didn't really have a chance. And as soon as she got on stage, it was over.
Right.
Because it was torpedoed anyway.
Yeah.
Right.
But was there another thing? And with her, it's even harder to answer that because the connection to gospel,
right.
the roots that came out of that, is that what it would just be? But what would be her... You know, what would be the Johnny Cash move for an older Whitney to be singing?
But I do think, to sort of tie together all these threads, maybe the movies that have been made do not tell us what Whitney's relationship to music are, but her live performances, I think, do.
Yeah, do.
Now, maybe she's just mimicking what Sissy taught her. Maybe Sissy said, oh, well, you take a break. You take a break here, and then you give a little bit of a side conversation, and then you repeat the note. Like, maybe Sissy did that. I never saw Sissy Houston perform live.
Right.
I don't know. But I felt like those kind of kinetic improvisational moments, that's Whitney Houston to me. Like, not just the pure texture of the voice, but the attitude and the kind of the casualness of the expertise.
I will also say, since I watched Can I Be Me Again last night, and I think this gets missed because there's no context put around it, but because it is tour footage, you see a lot of Whitney rehearsing her singers.
Yes.
Yes.
And telling her singers
what to do,
change this, modulate that, do this. There's at least like 3 or 4 different clips of her literally like rehearsing them and then saying, okay, no, do it this way. Okay, and let's take that.
There's
back.
One exactly. great moment of that in
with
Whitney.
Her brother.
Yes.
In Whitney as well, once her brother joins singers where she's coaching them through their part, that like jumps out as, okay, she's totally dialed into this.
Right.
Right.
It kind of flashes up there. And I think we were saying this before. I think the flaw from the Nick Broomfield film is with all that tour footage, you know, there would have been a way to really narrow the scope of what story that was and be able to look at something more focused that got, you know, closer to some of these things we're talking
right.
about, instead of we'll use that to try to tell the Whitney story,
right.
which it kind of can't deliver on.
I think that you find the same thing with Aretha Franklin, who is taking her musical genius is actually taken for granted. She arranged her songs. She is responsible for snatching Dionne Warwick's wig single-handedly, covering I Say a Little Prayer for You within a year of that song being a hit and making the definitive version because she arranged it. she arranged right. that version.
And because she was the music director, she was the writer.
Playing those piano yeah. parts and laying exactly. out what the arrangement of those songs were going to be. Absolutely.
And even people don't really talk about Aretha Franklin as a musical genius, and, even though this, I mean, she was a child prodigy.
Which is why Aretha hates everybody.
Exactly. But even Aretha enough. Now. I saw Aretha with my mom
oh, wow.
on Long Island maybe like a year ago, a year and a half, like pretty recently. And she was smashed. She smashed it.
I saw Aretha last.
Yeah, she smashed it.
In Poughkeepsie
in
last
the same
year.
Way.
And she was spectacular.
And in the same way that we're talking about of just like, I'm gonna be musical and the song doesn't matter. It almost literally right. doesn't matter what I'm singing, but the way, my approach, my texture, my
Aretha
choices.
Aretha is really good for that because Aretha will throw in a hallelujah at the end of a song that has nothing
to do with,
to do with. Like she will straight, like the Hammond organ will get going. Like I've seen her do it on TV tapings. Like, okay, Aretha just took everybody to church with her fur coat on.
Much as I would love to go out listening to some Aretha, and maybe we'll go home and listen to some Aretha now, I do want to close out with Whitney's Star Spangled Banner, not for any jingoistic purposes, but I do think it's important to hear what she did to that song. And yes, she did it casually, and yes, she did it in one take, but that doesn't lessen its sort of awe-inspiring capacities. So here is Whitney's Star Spangled Banner at the 1991 Super Bowl. That is our show. Thank you to everybody who joined me today. Thank you to Naima Cochran, Joe Coscarelli, Alan Light, Rich Jesuiak. Quick questions. There might be some Popcast merch and Popcast live event maybe coming up. If you are interested in either of those things, drop us an email. Tell us what's on your mind at popcastnytimes.com. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. And of course, subscribe, like iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, iHeartRadio, wherever you get your audio content. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We're out. Back next week.